Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor for Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between Highway 164 and Highway F, in Ridgeview Corporate Park. We're in the village of Whitefish Bay as well, in the Equitable Bank building, right across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for details. Our special guest today is Barry Mendelson. Barry, welcome back to Money Sense.
Appreciate it.
Fantastic. We just got back together now from our earlier visit in April of this year. And, you know, I'm just going to introduce you here for a moment. Barry is the CEO and founder of Capital Market Consultants, longtime friend of EIG, and certainly, you know, happy that you're, you know, able to provide us with some guidance and advice from time to time as we need it. Barry and his team have been operating for how many years, Barry?
21.
21 years. So very good. I know you've been on Money Sense numerous times with Karen and other EIG advisors. So we really appreciate you making the time for us today.
I always enjoy these calls.
Fantastic. So, you know, there's a lot that we could cover. You know, I was kind of thinking about this and, you know, like when we got together back in April, we were just getting into the new year. We were talking about 7 interest rate cuts. You know, we didn't know, still talking about inflation and hard landing, soft landing. Here we are now going into the fourth quarter. Today marks the day that we're jumping into the end of the year. A lot of things happening. We've got an election coming up in a handful of weeks. We've got the Fed, you know, moving, lowering rates recently here in the last week or so. So I thought maybe we'd just kind of start with an update on the markets. If you want to, you know, share any initial thoughts that you have on where the Fed is at and, you know, kind of how things are going for us in terms of like a report card for this year, if you were to give us a grade.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Let's start with the market. Year to date, the markets are doing, frankly, unbelievably well. Much better than the historic average, which on the one hand should give investors pause to enjoy what they're seeing on their custodial statements. But on the other hand, without being a doomsday sort of person, all these things sort of come to an end and markets revert to the average, the long-term average. And we've been living, so to speak, on borrowed time for quite a while. For example, the S&P 500 is up 21.5% so far this year through the end of last week. The long-term average on stocks is 10 to 11%.
That's phenomenal.
So,
I know.
So something's going to either cause investors to change their enthusiasm or their excitement about stocks. And there will have to be at some point in the future, some period of time where we have what many people will think is substandard rates of return,
Sure.
but they're going to have to be below 10% or 11% to achieve that long-term average of 10 or 11%. The growth index of large company stocks, which comprises and well comprises the tech stocks, is up about 24% so far this year through the end of last week. Interestingly, value stocks that are generally more conservative, they're somewhat more defensive, they're more cyclical in their economically cyclical in their orientation, which were behind tech stocks by so far, are making up some ground. And they're up about about 16 to 17% so far this year. And we think the reason that that's happening is because while the big tech stocks are going to continue to be the fastest growing stocks, the pace of their earnings growth is going to be slowing down. Still phenomenal growth, but it's going to be slowing down. And the growth rate of earnings in a lot of the other so-called 493 stocks in the S&P 500, they're going to be improving. So earnings improvement is going to be broadening. And so you're starting to see investors look at that and see that and decide how they want to take advantage of being an early mover and taking advantage of those improvements in value stocks. Mid-cap stocks are up about 14, 15%. Small company stocks, which have been extraordinarily volatile this year, are up about 11% this year. International markets are up 15% this year. Emerging markets are up 17%. In fact, emerging markets were up over 6% last week.
Wow.
And the reason is in, well, there are really two main reasons. One reason is that the Fed cut interest rates, and that contributes to the dollar, the US dollar weakening in its purchasing power relative to other currencies. And number two, the Chinese, which make up a pretty significant portion of the emerging market index, through a lot of stimulus and a cut in interest rates at their economy, and the thought is that that is going to have some positive impact on the performance of the Chinese economy and Chinese stocks, and hence that's why emerging markets really ran. So markets like emerging markets and developed international markets, which have lagged the US for years and years and years and years because of the strength of the dollar and the relatively high interest rates in the US, we may be on the cusp of that starting to change
I
so that
see.
international stocks start to perform a little bit better relative to US stocks. The bond market did pretty well in recent weeks because interest rates have come down. In fact, the entire spectrum of interest-bearing bonds, from very short-term bonds, 30-day T-bills, things like that, money market funds, all the way out to 30-year bonds, the interest rates have started to drop on all of them, and the yield curve is getting lower. And that's a combination of the Fed cutting rate. It's also a combination, it also reflects, at least we think, the fact that professional investors who invest in bonds think that the economy is going to be slowing down and interest rates are going to be coming down. And so they're looking to lock in these higher rates today. So there's been good demand and a good demand for bonds because of those factors.
Wow, so that's really interesting. Obviously, the inverse relationship between interest rates and bonds is something that, you know, is a concept that we saw work in reverse over the last 2 years with interest rates rising. Now we're in a Fed, you know, kind of change of stance, if you will. I'm curious, you know, just if you were to give us a grade for where we stand today, we ended the year today, what kind of year would we be? What would be our grade?
Well, for the equity market, it would be an A plus plus.
Wow, fantastic.
For the bond market, it would be sort of steady as she goes. Fairly classic sort of yields on bonds. Bonds have provided a total a positive total rate of return of anywhere, depending on maturity, anywhere between about 4 to 9, 4 to 8%.
Yeah,
So
we've.
they've done what they're supposed to do and been steady. And actually, as you pointed out, they've gone up in value because interest rates have gone down. So they've provided not only the coupon that's associated with the bond, but the bond itself has appreciated.
Yeah, I know. And we're going to talk quite a bit about, some things as it relates to interest rates. We also want to talk a little bit about the relationship between risk and return and what goes into that when people are thinking about how they, should be managing their portfolios. I'm also curious, because we're going to take a quick break here in a minute, to get some of your thoughts on some of the sectors that have done really well this year that have been really kind of driving the market. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be right back after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, wealth advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. We've been having a conversation with Barry Mendelson. Barry is with Capital Market Consultants. He is an absolute expert when it comes to understanding portfolio management and looking at quality investment strategies. Barry, I don't mind. I hope you don't mind. I want to call you Professor Mendelson. because every time we get together, I feel like you're teaching me something. So, before the break, we talked about a couple different things. We were going into down the path of the stock market performance for the year. We came off of 2023 with also a stellar performance year. So, as you mentioned earlier, we kind of have to plan for something to maybe change at some point, maybe a pullback. And later in
Well, see,
this, yeah.
Jamie, let me interrupt you for a second. To
Sure.
your point specifically, if you take a look at this year, but take a look at the last 12 months, the S&P 500 is up 36%.
Phenomenal.
But if you go back 3 years and you take into account 2022, which was a very poor year for the equity market, as I said earlier, stocks have a history of providing returns of about 10 to 11%. The last 3 years, the stock market has provided an 11% return,
Yep.
a 10.6% return. So the returns with stocks, and this gets to your risk and return question to an extent, and maybe it leads us into that. The returns on equities are unpredictable. You don't know how they're going to unfold. And it's that uncertainty that you have to live with, you learn to live with, that gives you an opportunity to have exposure. That if you look at the last year, the returns on the S&P 500 were 36%. If you look at the last 3 years, which takes into account a bad 2022, the returns are only 10.6%, which points to the fact that the returns on equities are uncertain. You don't know what they're going to be from year to year. You can have periods, which we have had in recent years, of extraordinary returns, and then you can have long periods of substandard returns. In fact, the decade from 2000 to 2000, at the end of 2009, the return on the S&P 500 was essentially zero. And then the second decade of the new century was fantastic. I don't remember what it was, but it was 17, 18%, maybe, if I recall correctly. And we're still in this period, this sort of honeymoon period of highly excess returns in the US equity market, which at some point will reverse for who knows what the reasons are going to be. But investors will be looking for other aspects, other areas of the equity markets that have been out of favor, that are relatively cheap, that look attractive from a price point of view, and the more expensive areas of the market where investors have been very enthusiastic, like tech, for example, those will tend to slow down and take a back seat to other parts of the economy, which sort of points out this issue of risk and return you were referring to. Bonds generally do not have the same kind of risk. Historically, they do not have the same kind of risk as stocks do. You don't have the same kind of volatility in bonds, although you did have a lot of bond volatility in the last year or two. But classically, they've not been as volatile. And so from an investor's point of view, going into building a portfolio or managing a portfolio, you have to know ahead of time that the returns on stocks are uncertain. They're not going to be double digit returns every year. They could be zero, they could be 36%, they could be all right. kinds of numbers. And so in order to get the benefit of those premium returns of 10 or 11% in the long run, you have to hold on to stocks for long periods of time so that you can right. live through the ups and the downs and get the excess return for putting up with the uncertainty and angst that sometimes goes along with owning stocks. And so right. from a practical point of view, from an advisor's point of view, in terms of putting portfolios together for clients, you've got to make sure that the client doesn't have more uncertainty, more equities built into their portfolio than they can tolerate from an emotional point of view. Absolutely. And so putting together a portfolio and constructing a portfolio is a combination of balancing what are the financial needs that the client has over time, what kind of return do they require to get to their financial goal, including savings and so forth, and how much volatility in the value of their account can they tolerate?
Right.
I and tell not you, have their skin crawl.
Yep. And we talk about that all the time. You know, it's probably one of the most important things that we try to get right when we sit down and work with our clients, trying to understand, you know, their cash flow, liquidity needs, where are places that they should be looking to have some safe money. I call it the sleep well at night money, SWAN. We, you know, what you refer to is risk, you know, risk tolerance. What are they willing to take on in order to meet that required rate of return for the planning, right? We can kind of put together some variables and try to understand some things that will be relative to like inflation numbers and potential for a return in terms of the stock market. Zooming out, you know, kind of looking at the last 3 years, the ups and downs, but zooming out, I think, you know, the S&P over the past couple decades has averaged somewhere in around that 10 to 11% range. So very interesting stuff. Let's go back just a minute. I want to touch on the AI, you know, the tech sector in terms of what has really kind of driven the demand there and any thoughts around how that might be working itself out within the markets in terms of the concept of AI becoming a reality.
Yes, I would not claim myself to be an expert on AI by any stretch of the imagination, but I will say the following. I've yet to hear anyone who I think is a credible source who doesn't think that AI is A, here to stay, B, revolutionary, and will have very pervasive effects in our economy. What they are, I don't think anyone, what they all are and what all the potential derivatives are at this point still unknown. From an investment point of view, the stocks which have benefited the most so far are the firms that have produced the microchips that allow AI to operate. And that would be a company like NVIDIA. Mm-hmm. In other words, you can't have AI without the chips.
Sure. And I,
so they're the first movers.
I understand there's still quite a bit of things in the supply chain aspect of that that are holding up or helping different areas like the automobile industry and the semiconductor space. Just very interesting.
Right. Yeah. How all of that, I mean, NVIDIA can't, as I understand it, NVIDIA can't produce enough microchips for what the economy wants. Now, you have the manufacturers of the microchips, and then you have the so-called hyperscalers. The hyperscalers are firms like Microsoft and Google and Meta and Apple, and they're going to take the chips, and they're building these enormous data centers, mm-hmm. and then they're going to sort of help people get access to AI. It doesn't do anyone on this call any good to have a supercomputer chip, that can help with AI. You need some sort of a program to enable that, and you need a source to do that. And so the hyperscalers, these big gigantic tech companies, are the ones doing most of the buying. And they're building these gigantic data centers. But somewhere down the road, what's going to happen is other firms that are software companies that people plug into, whether it's Microsoft Word or Salesforce or whatever the application is.
Sure.
AI has to filter all the way down into those software programs. So we have many years of development in infiltration of AI through American industry. So so we understand what its full implications are.
Yeah, and it, you know, a lot of people have compared it to the .com, which obviously we could probably have a whole show about that. But when you think about what that meant back in the late 90s versus what AI and the big tech companies today, big data, big computing, you know, they have a much different foothold in that space. So like you said,
yes.
I agree. I think it's here to stay. So we are at the break. We've been meeting with Barry Mendelson, our special guest from Capital Market Consultants. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Money Sense. We've been meeting with Barry Mendelson, Capital Market Consultants, friend of EIG, talking about a lot of different things here today relating to the markets and just ways to approach, you know, thinking about your finances and investing in general. Barry, I was going to ask you about some of the importance of, you know, obviously, when we put portfolios together, we have to diversify, right? We got to make sure that things are set up in a fashion that if international is lagging, we may not be happy about that, but we can't time the market to understand when to buy international. So we're going to own it in our portfolio versus maybe looking at fixed income, right? Bonds, how important that is. By the way, I've got kind of an analogy I share with people about bonds. When they're in the portfolio, it's kind of like a sailboat. Think about everything below the waterline you can't see. Everything above the waterline, you can. You could see the sail, and the wind is pushing that boat across the lake or wherever it might be. And that's volatility. That's the stock market. The wind and, you know, things are pushing that boat along. But underneath, what you don't see is that ballast of that ship that's kind of keeping the ship right. So I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about bonds, the performance of bonds. They haven't done well over the past, decade or so. But is there a case to hold bonds?
Well, yes, for sure, certainly that's true. We talked earlier about the uncertainty about how stock returns unfold. We talked about the fact that the first decade of this century, the return on the S&P 500 was zero. But that wasn't true for bonds. Yes, it's true that in an environment of rising interest rates, bonds are not going to provide a great return. But the thing about bonds is, relative to stocks, their volatility is a fraction of the volatility of stocks historically. And their annualized deviation of returns, they're more steady. The returns are more steady. The volatility is lower. And that's the ballast that you're talking about. Sure. And you need to have a certain amount of that in the portfolio to dampen the effects of the volatility of the stock market, and getting that asset allocation right between the steadier part of the portfolio and the more volatile part of the portfolio is probably the most important part of an advisor's job.
Absolutely. It helps keep the ship right, you know, because fixed income is exactly what it is. It's an income, it's a coupon payment, it's coming in very sensitive to interest rates. But I think that kind of leads me into understanding, if we're looking at portfolios, you know, we have to compare them to something. We have to understand, how do I know that this fund or this investment choice is performing to its expectations? And I always think about that quilt chart, right? That chart, it looks like a lot of colored boxes on a piece of paper. It's usually a rectangle. And it shows each one of these: international, US developed, we've got the bonds, real estate, all these other things on this quilt chart. And every year they're stacked in a different order because the returns are different in each year.
That's right.
So with benchmarks, I would love for you to weigh in on the importance of looking at benchmarks and understanding what they are and how what goes into them.
Well, I'd say two things. Let me say a few things about benchmarks. The first thing that I think is important to note is that while benchmarks are relevant, I don't think you sort of live and die by whether you outperformed a benchmark or not. The most important benchmark that an investor should be thinking about is the return that they need to get to their financial goal. It's not, did they beat a benchmark? So a person's financial goal and the achievement of that has to be one in the portfolio is more important than whether you beat an artificial or a synthetic benchmark. But to your point, talking more specifically about benchmarks, benchmarks represent each benchmark, and there are literally thousands of benchmarks. Popular benchmarks would be like the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Standard and Poor's 500 and the Russell Mid Cap and the Russell Small Cap and so on and so forth. Each represents a different slice, a different segment of the capital markets, whether it's a segment of the bond market like the Bloomberg corporate high yield bond market or the credit market or the US Treasury market. Each one of these segments of the capital markets has own benchmark. And then there are blends of benchmarks. And the point of those is to essentially do the following, to create at least a reference point or a gauge against which people who are managing money can compare their performance against this benchmark. Having said that, managers or professional investors or individuals who manage their own portfolio rarely ever beat the benchmark, an appropriate benchmark year after year after year after year. And the
Right.
reason is because a benchmark, for example, the S&P 500, contains 500 stocks. Some of them are growth stocks, some of them are value stocks, some of them are right in the middle. They're called core stocks. A typical manager has a bias, has a preference, has an intellectual point of view that says, I think if I invest in stocks that have these features, I'll do better over the long run. And so that style choice that the professional investor makes may occasion them to wildly outperform the benchmark at times, and at other times, underperform the benchmark. For example, if you're a growth style manager and you like to buy stocks that produce steady, consistent, reliable earnings growth, that may in the long run be a fabulous strategy and maybe a winning strategy. And I think it is a winning strategy if you buy those growth stocks at the right price. But guess what? In the last couple of years, if you didn't own Nvidia in the right amount, and you didn't own Microsoft, and you didn't own Apple, and you didn't own the so-called Mag 7, you underperformed the S&P 500 by massive amounts. Not because you changed your strategy, not because you suddenly lost your mind, but because that particular style, the sort of, as we say, sort of professionally, the little pond in which you fish for the stocks that are of interest to you, that have the features and characteristics of growth and earnings growth and lack of debt and all of those things that you find attractive in a company, those are out of favor. And even though they may be great companies and they may be performing well, very well, they're just not growing at 40, 50, 60, 70%. They're never designed to grow that much. And so you have to be. That's why I say the most important benchmark is the return the client has to achieve to reach their financial goals. Secondarily, you can use a benchmark as a rough gauge, sort of an estimate. And sometimes you have to know that if you have a more conservative strategy, that's used against the benchmark, sometimes it's going to underperform because it's less risky.
Right.
And there are going to be other times when the less risky parts of that benchmark do really well and your manager is going to outperform.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It kind of takes me back to that story about Buffett's bet, right? You know, having, you know, different fund managers, hedge fund managers that went against the S&P 500 index. And that's where, you know, kind of looking at that and understanding these benchmarks and how to articulate the right funds to buy, they shattered, you know, the bet, which went from 2008 to 2016. The index beat all of the funds that were in that range. Very fascinating stuff. So that takes me back to kind of another thought or another question about the complexity of different types of investments. There's different cost structures involved with these, you know, different mutual funds, whether it's an active or a passive fund. Is that something that you pay close attention to when you're looking at performance and putting together your thoughts on what to hold?
Yes. I mean, it is a factor. It is not the largest factor, but it is a factor. Our belief, and I think it's been empirically borne out, we've tested this, we've studied this, that skillful managers, a skillful group of investment managers working together can overcome the cost of the active management. I'm not saying all, I'm not even saying most, I'm saying some. And that's why you spend time doing research to try to find those some to put into the portfolio like the Ellenbecker Investment Group does. That's exactly what you're trying to do. And so you can achieve your goals with active, you can achieve your goals with passive, you can achieve your goals with a blend of the two. I don't know that there's any one right way of doing things. I think the most important thing, again, is to get the asset allocation right. And whether you're using passive or active investments, you're going to do fine. I would say one final thing about that. One of the advantages to my way of thinking of active management, if you've selected the right manager, you can get that premium return, but you can get that premium return while taking less risk than the market. So that certain active fund styles are less risky than passive investments that basically own the market.
Yeah, there's an absolute case for both. There's interdependency between active and passive. There's no question. So very thoughtful approach. I think it really depends on the, you know, the area of the portfolio that you're focused on the most. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back in the fourth segment, I want to just talk about kind of putting all this together. And you know, we're going to touch base on, you know, more planning and the behavioral side of this. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Ellenbecker Investment Group Wealth Advisor, here with Barry Mendelson. Before the break, we were talking a lot about the benchmark aspect of things, how to approach that. I really like your philosophy is, yes, all of that is important when we really do the analytics, but we want to make sure that we're tying in the return to the goal, you know, and that's something that when I studied financial planning about 20 years ago to get my CFP, they focused heavily on, you know, making sure that we're not trying to hit a home run every single inning, when we've already won the game, right? And I remember early in my career, I was fortunate enough to have someone share their portfolio with me. And I did an analysis on it. And I said, wow, you're retired. You are almost 100% in equity funds. You've got about five different funds. They're all mutual funds. And three of the five are all almost identical. They're overlapping in the way that they approach the theme of the investment. So after some thoughtful analysis, we realized you don't need to do that. You can take some of the risk out of your portfolio. We can reallocate to some fixed income, and then, of course, build a thoughtful portfolio for that person. So I really like that example, and I think it's really important that people should be thinking about that. So let's go back to the risk-free rate of return today. So U.S. Treasuries, we've seen the yields come down a little bit. What are your thoughts on with the interest rate environment we're in, Barry? How quickly we could see those rates go down?
I think that the answer lies in taking a look at how the Federal Reserve has managed the their interest rate policy over time. I think if anything is true about the Federal Reserve, they try to be transparent, and they try to sort of go slowly. They don't need to upset the market with surprises. That's the last thing that they want to do. So there was a bit of a surprise last week when they lowered interest rates by 50 basis points. But our thought on that is, on reflection, that the reason that they did that is because they're beginning to get concerned, although they didn't necessarily express it. They're beginning to get a little concerned about the softness in the labor market. Remember, the Federal Reserve has two mandates. One is to control inflation, to manage inflation in the economy. The second is to help achieve so-called full employment, whatever that is. No one actually knows precisely what that is, but we're certainly at full employment right now for sure. But the unemployment rate has gone from 3.4% to 4.2%, which is where it is right now. And in the depths of the pandemic, we had unemployment. Well, I should say the great financial crisis, we had unemployment at 10%. That's millions and millions of people out of work. And so the Fed is now going to, now that they believe that inflation is sustainably headed towards 2%, they're going to start turning their attention to the labor market to make sure it doesn't continue to get weaker and weaker and weaker. Because ultimately, what that means, if people are laid off and hiring goes down, it means there are less people to buy goods and services, and that means the gross domestic product of the economy starts to slow down. We're currently at about most recently at 3%, and it looks like we're going to come in somewhere around 2.5% for the third quarter when we start getting releases here in the next handful of days. I would say that the Fed is going to keep their eyes very closely on what happens in the labor market. And when I say labor market, I mean things like what are called first-time unemployment claims. Those are people who are laid off. A second thing would be how many job openings are there? What is the unemployment rate? How frequently are people quitting their jobs? How fast are people getting hired? Those sorts of things, which are sort of the features and the dynamics and the profile of the labor market, is what the Fed is going to be looking at. And they want to make sure that these factors are not slowing down too fast. And so what they did last week was to give the economy a little jolt with a half a percent rate cut. We think there will be a rate cut in November. There'll be another rate cut in December, but those will be a little more measured and more like a quarter of a percent and a quarter of a percent. Keep in mind that when the Fed makes a cut in interest rates, it takes about 6 months to 9 months for that cut in interest rates to filter its way into the economy, so
Sure.
the economy actually starts feeling it and can start behaving and acting on a lower interest rate environment. I think one of the first areas that's going to improve, it may still take another 2 or 3 months, will be for the real estate market to improve. Because mortgage rates are down substantially, and we haven't started seeing, we're only now starting to see people close on houses, but you won't see the sale activity for another couple months,
Sure.
30 days to 60 days before the actual closing takes place. The closings that are taking place right now were for interest rates that were locked in 30 days, 60 days ago, which were substantially higher.
Yeah.
So interest rates coming down will be a bit of a tailwind for the real estate market. Be good for housing prices. It'll be good for the wealth effect it has on people's home, the value of people's homes, and so forth, and should increase sales activity both for existing and new homes.
Yes, real estate market is still somewhat hot. Inventories we saw improved a bit, but still a lot of cash buyers out there. We're still, talking to clients about, not being discouraged about the higher interest rates just because it's so important to, consider that. Don't wait if you're thinking about doing it. But we have in about, let's see, 5 weeks, we've got an election coming up. What are your thoughts on how the Fed may approach the next couple meetings, just being so close to the election? And then any initial thoughts about, as we kind of close things up here today, what you found with the results of an election, no matter what the outcome is? Well, how does that affect markets?
Elections are generally pretty good years for the stock market. To your question about the Fed, the next Fed meeting in November is after the election. So we were actually surprised to an extent that the Fed even did anything before the election. And the fact that they did 50 basis points sort of gives you a sense for, if you want to call it you want to call it this, their concern about what's happening in the labor market. And they want to try to get ahead of any further slowdown in the labor market by lowering the cost of borrowing and keeping businesses expanding and hiring and not laying people off. But we don't think, if you take a look at the data, it doesn't look like the labor market is slowing down all that fast. And so unless data comes out in the next 6 to 8 weeks that it's slowing down a lot faster than we now know, we would expect the next rate cut to be 25 basis points.
Okay. Well, very good information, very insightful. Really appreciate all of your knowledge and what you've shared with us today, Barry. I want to just say a couple of closing remarks. Any final thoughts before we wrap up the show today, Barry?
No, I think I'm good. I think we had a good show today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So, again, I've been meeting with Barry Mendelson with Capital Market Consultants. This is Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor at EIG. Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 and on Sundays from 12 to 1. If you enjoyed today's show and you want to learn more about us, we would be happy to share how we approach doing wealth management for our clients. Not only do we help people invest, but we help them with their estate planning, their taxes. We help them analyze what they have in place today versus maybe what they should have in place in the future. And we also bring a lot of that into the family dynamic and family fold and help people figure it out. So for more information, visit ellenbecker.com or give us a call, 262-691-3200. Our website has got a lot of great information, and we also do some really great events throughout the year, and those are open to everyone. So we're happy to have anyone go on our website and sign up for one of the things coming up maybe next year. We did a car show. We had a Veterans Appreciation event. Last 2 weeks ago, I did Discovering National Parks. So we're always doing fun and neat stuff. Up ahead, we've got Medicare planning and Social Security. So if people are interested in learning about that, please check out our website and or sign up for our newsletter. As always, we hope that we've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. Remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen. Thank you and have a great day.